Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. And we're joined in studio by Katrina Green. Katrina, thank you so much for calling in to us. How are you keeping?
Thanks a million, Greg. Yeah, I'm doing well, thank God.
Out of your comfort zone, but we are going to, over the next few minutes, get you firmly settled into it. How's that?
Thank you. Yeah, great.
Okay. Katrina, you're a teacher from Gordhawk. I'm sure you're well known in and around the area and beyond. But presumably in 2018... a huge change happened in your life.
Well, 2018, I had my first daughter, Dorothy. It was 2021 when I
was it okay?
With, breast cancer. I guess, yeah.
Okay.
So, Dorothy was just
well. That is a huge event, yeah. I suppose. So that does change your life.
I won't brush over that, but yeah, that was a huge event. Having my daughter in 2018, but it was actually the March when she was about to turn three that I was diagnosed with breast cancer.
Okay. And did you discover that yourself?
Yeah, I just found it randomly myself as quite a small lump on a Monday evening and went to my own GP then, Dr. Dan Gill in Flacara on the Thursday. And within 2 weeks, I was diagnosed with breast cancer.
So it all just happened
very, very quickly.
And as a new mum as well, relatively new.
Yeah,
so for years, it's normal.
Just kind of finding your feet and, you know, becoming comfortable in motherhood.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, a very young when you were diagnosed.
Yeah, I was 37. So, you know, you're like, cancer's not on your radar.
No, and,
you
I was know, going to say,
it's, you know, not something that you're looking out for. So I was very, very lucky to find that lump and to be diagnosed so quickly. So I'm grateful for that.
Yes, for sure. And how quickly then did things move in terms of treatment? And
Very quickly, Greg. So I was diagnosed on the 26th of March and I had the mastectomy on the 20th of April in Galway. So it was amazingly quick. And then from there, I was to start chemotherapy quite quickly after that. But the path changed for me then, as 2 weeks after the mastectomy, I actually found out that I was 8 weeks pregnant. So that kind of, you know, brought things to a halt for a standstill for 2 weeks till the team decided what to do and what was going to happen going forward. So, yeah, so things took a little bit of a turn.
And what were the implications of all of that, Katrina?
Really what it meant was that my my treatment couldn't begin until the first trimester of pregnancy had passed, so week 13. That was really the only massive implication, that I had to wait an extra few weeks for the chemotherapy. I still received the same chemotherapy I would have received had I not been pregnant, but just at a later stage. So I had 16 rounds of chemotherapy in total, 10 whilst I was pregnant with my daughter, Mary Bridget. Mm. And then when she was 10 days old, I continued back into the treatment and I had 6 more rounds of chemotherapy then.
And I'm kind of reminded maybe of sort of the conversation at the time of COVID and, mm-hmm. and whether pregnant women should be should get a vaccination or whatever, and maybe they shouldn't, and then they should. And this is a big treatment that you had scheduled. What was your feelings progressing with that treatment whilst pregnant? Did you have any doubts, or was it a leap of faith in medicine, or how would you describe it?
I suppose, as you can imagine, Greg, it was very, very scary, but I was really put at ease by my oncologist, Dr. Duffy, an amazing woman. She had told me that she had rang hospitals in Dublin where there was a higher demographic of women who had been pregnant with breast cancer, and she still wasn't fully content, so she called a hospital in America. So she was giving me all this information, telling me that they were doing this in America, they were doing this in Dublin, now we were going to do this in Letterkenny. You know, and she filled me with great confidence in her and her staff, and, you know, I really, you know, I wasn't massively concerned, but as a pregnant mother anyway, until you get your baby in your arms, you know, you are worried and you are, you know, you're always on edge and you can't fully relax until you hold that baby. But I suppose I just had to trust in God and trust in the medicine, and just went for it and, you know, tried to stay positive. And on the 26th of November, then they handed me my baby girl, and, you know, it was the most amazing day.
And what's her name?
Mary Bridget.
Mary Bridget.
Yeah.
Do you call her Mary B or Mary Bridget?
Mary Bridget for now.
Does anyone else call her Mary B?
No, they're too afraid of me to do that.
Right, okay. And, you know, I think you've recognised too, and it must be a testament to who you are as well, in that at that time, you know, there was research, there were people that had went before you that received treatment during pregnancy. And I think you were minded of those maybe who were the first or didn't know what the implications might be, or had to make decisions blindly.
Yeah, like I can't imagine what that must have been like for that first pregnant woman or the women that followed her that didn't have the research, because had I not had that conversation with Dr. Duffy, you know, I would have been massively scared. And you are very much, you know, aware that you have cancer and you do need this life-saving treatment. I did have a three-year-old daughter that I have to be alive for. So, you know, there was massive decisions to be made. But because I had research, because that brave woman handed over her arm to those nurses and took chemotherapy while pregnant, you know, the research was there for women like me and women to follow me, because we know it won't stop with me, unfortunately. So, yeah, so it is, I do often think of those women that had no research and how very, very brave they were.
And, you know, I mean, if you ever sort of, not you, but generally, if we ever feel, you know, you know, sort of like in terms of our responsibility, our children, we don't always have to think if we're going to be there or not. We don't allow ourselves necessarily to contemplate that.
Yeah.
Or particularly, I think, in your 30s, you know, getting a cancer diagnosis and facing into that treatment. If you weren't aware of all the complications and implications and the reality of our mortality, my word, it came in like a wrecking ball, didn't it, to sort of bring all of that into sharp focus for you, Katrina.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. I hope we can also say hello to Evelyn O'Rourke, a very well-known broadcaster, journalist, and indeed a cancer survivor herself. Evelyn, can you hear me okay? No, I think Evelyn is muted. I'll just see if we can get Evelyn. I might kick her out. And
hello.
Oh, Evelyn, you are there. Thank you so much indeed, Evelyn O'Rourke.
Good morning. How are you?
Lovely. And listening to Katrina's story here, Evelyn, you have made a programme in which Katrina features. So before we talk, a little bit about Katrina, can you tell us about the show that you've made and why that you wanted to make it and what you hope to bring across through it?
Yes, of course. We are so thrilled with this programme and so excited by it. And to be honest, Katrina agreed to come into it with us. So the idea was, Greg, right, I went through my own cancer experience 12 years ago, really similar to Katrina. We can talk about that in a minute. That's why we're such great friends. But basically, I've just really been interested in the whole area of cancer research and just trying to bring that positive sense of what we're doing here in Ireland. So I've done lots of different things over the years. This is my latest project. And the reason I loved this was the idea was so simple, right? The idea was to get two of our world-class level cancer researchers living and working in Ireland, working with Breakthrough Cancer Research, that amazing research charity based in Cork, to get them in conversation with survivors, people like myself and Katrina, the ordinary people as we call ourselves, and to, instead of just having one gang in the lab and us kind of outside trying to work out what's going on, the idea was to get us all together into a room and just to have that conversation, like what is happening, what's there for us, what was our experience, so that we as the real people at the other end, Trina said so beautifully there, the women who hand our arm over to the medics, so that we could explain what it was like for us and they could tell us about the work that they're doing. So hopefully both sides kind of left really inspired, even more enthusiastic and more committed to working on this, because Katrina and Anne-Marie O'Sullivan, who's the other woman featured in the programme, they're just extraordinary. And what they've been through is, you know, really tough, but they've emerged from this with such elegance, such truth, such power. They're just wonderful women. To have them in the room with these two people who are committing their lives to this work. I mean, these are the brightest, smartest people you could meet, and they're dedicating their professional lives to working on different ways to approach and to tackle this whole nightmare around cancer that we're all so committed to. So for me to get on, to just be in the middle, working out the conversation like a ringmaster, was just a joy and a privilege. I am so excited about this programme and what it's going to show people about that magic conversation.
Yeah, and what is a privilege too, and it's based off of your previous work, Evelyn, and your reputation, is the trust for people like Katrina and Anne-Marie to trust you with their story, but also the professionals as well too. Do you know what I mean? So as I say, that's born from your years experience, but it is a privilege to sort of be able to have earned that.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I suppose I'm just so sincere about it. And can I talk for a minute about how Katrina and I met? Because I just think this is such an amazing thing. I mean, I've written a story, I've done a documentary about the fact that I discovered that I was pregnant with my second baby, Ross, and I got a cancer diagnosis kind of in the same week. So it was a really shocking time. And I had an 8-month-old baby at the time. So it was all now crazy. So since then, I've been very public about my story, and different women have got in touch over the years, because when you think about it, women can be kind of fertile for such an amount of time. It's not surprising that it happens that women will also have to deal with a cancer diagnosis in the middle of pregnancy, right? But I was there one day, next thing a little pop on my phone on my Instagram, and it was this message from this beautiful person called Katrina saying, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I have heard about your story. I have just been diagnosed with breast cancer. I am pregnant, you know, And I just immediately went back, give me your number. And I rang her number, and it was Katrina, and she was sitting at the table with her mom. And we had the most amazing chat on the phone because somebody had done that to me. And I was able to say to her, whatever about the medical side of it, I have been there. I put my arm out there. They put the chemotherapy drugs into my arm. And my beautiful baby Ross survived all that and is fabulous. And then he'll enjoy this, Greg. Ross came into the room and he's like any 10-year-old, you know. And I said to him, quick, say hello to this strange lady. And he was all, who's this lady I'm saying hello to? And I was all, say hello to someone. Oh, why is, you know, why is anybody asking me questions? But I just needed her to hear him.
And that was Ross, the 10-year-old. Wow. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Can I ask Katrina what that conversation meant to you? That, and not only did you have the reassurance of Evelyn, but with the cooperation of Ross, she produced that evidence, and he was willing to partake. Was that an important conversation for you, Katrina? Because it's so someone you get it. She's Evelyn's been there. She gets it. She's been through it, and I can take that with me. How important was that?
Yeah, it was. You know, I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that afternoon when she called. And I remember the awkwardness of poor Ross. And like, he was telling me he was in a Gael skull, and I was trying to talk to him. And he was awkward, but I was just great. He's just an awkward teenage bond boy. And it was really, really something else. And it was really special. And it took away a lot of fear and anxiety that I was experiencing at the time. And you just think, okay, I can do this, you know. And it was amazing. And it was very generous of Evelyn to do that for me.
And Evelyn, Anne-Marie's story is somewhat different, isn't it? Because she herself is a, I don't know, what do you call it, a trailblazer? But do you know, we talked earlier on of the first women that put that arm out. To some extent, Anne-Marie is that person too, is she?
Oh, unbelievable. I mean, Anne-Marie's courage and strength. And in the documentary, I don't give too much away, but she did get married after all that. And we have these stunning photographs. Anne-Marie's had an extraordinary kind of couple of few years. But Anne-Marie's a writer. She's a thinker. She's a journalist. She's an advocate. And she decided that she would just go with the best treatment that was on offer for her. And in her case, part of her treatment involved a kind of a new level of this drug. And on the morning that she was getting it, right, the doctor said to her, we think you're the first in Ireland. And then she went to check the phone and said, well, you're certainly the first in Munster. So, I mean, Anne-Marie has just been so fearless in her pursuit for the best treatment for her, writing about it, talking about it, as you alluded to earlier, trusting us to tell her story. I think she's just the power of what she says and what she talks about. She's a busy journalist, a busy writer. She's got a beautiful family, two stunning children. You know, she's got a lot going on. And yet she has just taken the time to step back and share her story to help other women. I mean, I would 100% accept and totally understand if people just want to disappear after treatment and, you know, recover and do their own thing privately. I'm just so sort of honoured really that Anne-Marie took the step to come forward and talk to myself, Katrina and the others about her story and share the decisions that she made, because we are all about that moment, that dreadful moment when you're told the news that you're dreading. You need hope. At that moment sitting there, you need to know that there's solutions, that there are answers, that there are options. And that's what this programme is about, and that's what these people are dedicating their lives to. And Katrina and I'm putting words in our mouth, but if telling our bit helps them in their lab and helps break cancer research, get more money and get more funding into this, then hopefully we just get more and more control over this disease.
Yeah. Katrina, what was it like, the experience of speaking to the medical professionals, that part of the programme for you?
Yeah, I found that very interesting, Greg, because to be honest, you don't spend too much time thinking about what's going on behind the scenes. You know, you just turn up to your appointments, you take your medicine, you know, you take your tablets when you get home, and you don't, I personally didn't stop and think about these people, the real people behind the research. And it was really, really lovely and really moving to actually be in the same room as these super intelligent people and listen to them talking and the dedication and the hours that they spend in the lab. And, you know, it's quite moving, you know, and really amazing that there's such amazing work going on in Ireland in regards to research to cancer.
Yeah, and I think this is why this programme might even resonate more so in Donegal than elsewhere, because we have a really good track record in cancer research through the Cancer Ball and some of the advances and first time things that we're trialling and doing up here. So Evelyn, just lastly to you then, talk to us about the programme, i.e. when it is on, if you don't mind, Evelyn, because we kept that to the end.
Yeah. Actually, just to say, I was up in Ballyshannon there a few weeks ago.
You were at that event, were you? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. The conversation with Tommy Gorman, just to remind people to go look for help and support and services. It's there, lots of support in the Northwest, you're dead right. The programme, and we're so excited for it now, is on Thursday night, this Thursday the 22nd. It's at 8:30 p.m. on TG Cahir. It's full subtitles, Greg. Let's be straight on this. Sometimes people can be a bit wary about it. Beautiful Gaelic, Katrina's Gaelic puts me to shame, of course. But there are subtitles there as well. And we would just love people to give it, you know, half an hour of their time. And I know people say about cancer documentaries, they always say, don't worry, it's not too dark. Like, honestly, this is the most hopeful, positive. It looks beautiful. The lads of Bow Media made it. It's beautiful. The message from Breakthrough Cancer Research, that amazing charity, is just so inspiring. And I really would encourage people to just flick it on. And I think you'll be really, really inspired and encouraged by it. I certainly was looking back to it last week.
Evelyn, thanks for your time this morning. Have a lovely day.
Thank you, Greg.
Bye-bye. Take care. Katrina, Evelyn mentioned there who she wants to reach. But, I mean, beyond that, you, is it to some extent, do you want to maybe for someone else replicate that conversation you had with Evelyn at the kitchen table, that maybe if you reach a person and such is life, you could be a person that has that consultation in that week that maybe needs to hear about your and Mary Bridget's story because she's tied into all of this, of course.
She is, unknowingly.
Yeah.
Because I suppose the part that Evelyn never actually mentioned there was I was actually watching a documentary. I was unaware of Evelyn's experience with breast cancer, but I was actually watching a show on Teach Care that she had done years previous. And it was like 2 weeks after I'd found out I was pregnant. And that's when I reached out to her. So it was actually from watching her on TV. So, you know, if it gives one person that little bit of hope. And, you know, I also feel that I have this for my own girls now. I have this documented and it's very special to me. And, you know, I'm really glad that I took part in the programme now. And it's something special to have going forward.
Have you had a chance to see it yet?
Yeah, we were in Cork last week, myself and my husband, Cahal, and the two girls. And they did a viewing with us and it was really beautiful.
Because we talk about your experience, but it's all of yours, isn't it? It is your firstborn and Cahal's and the rest of the family. And because it comes as a shock and a gunk to everyone.
Everyone is hit by it. Like my family and Cahal's family, and they were so supportive of us. And, you know, it will be nice to see because it is a very positive show.
And the funny thing, not funny, but it is kind of funny, is that what we see is that often, and I think maybe even particularly for women, is that the person who gets the diagnosis often is the one that ends up reassuring everyone else that everything's going to be okay.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you know
what
I mean?
Yeah.
So don't worry, I'm going to do that. No, I'm going to be okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just the, you know, it's not as if women have enough to go through, but then they have to counsel other people through their experience.
Oh, we try.
I know. And how are you and Mary Bridget and the family, everyone's?
We're doing great and my health is great and you're getting a sense of, you know, being out the other side now and feels like a full stop to it now. And you know, you try and keep it in the rear view mirror as much as possible and just move forward and hope to God that everything stays calm and we just move forward together now and make new memories
and enjoy your family.
Thank you.
All right, Katrina, it's been lovely having you on the programme.
Thank you.
And it's clear that Evelyn's a lovely person too and someone nice to work with, and you said kindred spirits, if that's the right phrase. But anyway, and the reason your Irish is better than hers is because you're using proper Irish.
She signed off there. She better be, Greg.
Okay, Katrina, thanks so much for calling across. That's Katrina Green there. And the show is on TG Cahir this Thursday, the 22nd of June at 8:30 p.m. And as was pointed out, and it's important to mention this once again, actually, because it is a heavy subject for some, but this is a story of hope, of perseverance, and a tribute to the remarkable individuals who are working tirelessly to find new, better, kinder, smarter treatments. And I think maybe comes at the right time because there is a bit of a anti-medicine thing going on at the moment, being perpetrated by some very, very rich people. But anyway, okay, we welcome into studio and say good morning now to Sean Murphy, manager at Letterkenny University Hospital. Sean, thank you for calling up.
No problem, Greg.
It's good to have you with us. Right, just a few bits of news. Should we start with the hospital's new pathway to excellence unveiled last week? What's this about?
Okay, so as you know from your own coverage, over the last number of years, we've had a number of reviews of our services, which actually identified some key either failings in the way we were doing things or opportunities to significantly improve the way we do things. And working with SAILTA at the end of 2021, early 2022, we set about looking at how do we actually take the learning from these reviews, as opposed to just responding review by review. How do we actually take a much more proactive approach? And the SAILTA executive team commissioned EY, the management consultancy group, to actually come and facilitate a number of workshops with the senior management team in the hospital and the senior management team in SAILTA. And I suppose, you know, when we talk about senior management, I think it's always important. People think of managers as people like myself as the hospital manager. But senior management team include our clinical directors. So we have consultants in five different areas of the hospital. We have five directorates. We have the medical directorate, which is medicine and emergency medicine, perioperative, which is anesthetics and surgery. We have women and children's. We have pathology, and we have radiology. And then we have an extra sixth directorate, which is the cancer directorate, which pulls together cancer services across the hospital. Mm-hmm. So we have a consultant lead for each of those directorates. And we have a director of nursing. Everybody has to bring back the matrons. We have a director of nursing, and we have a director of midwifery. And at SAILTA level, we have the same structure. In all the SAILTA hospitals, we have this structure. But so within SAILTA, they have a group clinical director for medicine. So they have somebody, like Letterkenny has a director for medicine. They have somebody in Galway for the hospital, but then they have a consultant who's the group clinical director for medicine, etc. So it was bringing the chief nurses and chief director of nursing and the chief and the clinical directors and the chief clinical director over the whole group, together with our clinical directors, our nurse directors, our managers. Tony Canavan is the chief executive officer of SAILTA, and Cosgrove is the chief operating officer of SAILTA, and our team and their team together. And we had five workshops throughout 2022, and we looked at various aspects of our service. And from those workshops, we identified a number of actions to take forward. But one of the first actions that we felt absolutely needed to be done was to actually agree and identify and very clearly state what is the role of Letterkenny University Hospital? Where does it fit within the SAILTA group? Where does it fit within the Irish healthcare system? We are one of the busiest Model 3 hospitals in the country. And maybe if you bear with me for a second, because Model 3, that means nothing to people outside the health service. So hospitals, when the HSE was restructuring and grouping hospitals into hospital groups, it categorised hospitals. So Model 4 is the highest category of hospitals, the tertiary specialist centres, hospitals that provide regional or national levels of service. So this, like the St. James's, the Mater, the Beaumont, Cork University Hospital, and Galway University Hospital, Limerick also. Model 3 is, when I worked in the NHS, we called it district general hospitals. There were hospitals that didn't provide regional or national services, but provided a range of services to the local community, but a comprehensive range. So it wasn't, it basically provided everything from like surgical services, emergency medicine, critical care, obstetrics and paediatrics, etc. And then Model 2 is the sort of more local level hospital where you don't have an emergency department in critical care. So we have one Model 2 in SAILTA, it's Roscommon. It has a minor injuries unit. It has predominantly day surgery and longer term facilities. It's more than a community hospital, but not a full Model 3. So if you take Letterkenny, we are about the second busiest Model 3 hospital in the country. We're certainly the busiest Model 3 outside. So the only hospital in SAILTA that is busier than us is Galway.
Which is level 4.
Which is level 4. So the question is, how do we reflect that? And when we talk about developing services for Letterkenny, what do we need to actually be building in order to meet that need? So, and sometimes we have divergent views. Those of us who work in Letterkenny, we want to provide as much as humanly possible to our community in our community, not to be sending patients out to other centres.
So can I break this down a little bit so in a more understandable way? Could it be a hypothetical situation whereby you and your team are saying this is what we want to do, what we're capable of doing or what we could provide, and you might have someone somewhere else saying, well, no, we feel it would be better if we concentrate services in this particular place. So rather than you do it, that the people might travel to us to do it. Could that be a typical example of what you're talking about there? Just so we understand.
It wouldn't necessarily be the typical example, but it is
an
example.
It could be an example. Typical is the wrong word.
So if I go back, so there are national clinical programs. So nationally, there is a strategy for how services should be delivered. And then within the region, SAILTA has strategies for how services should be developed. They're always evolving, particularly the regional services. We're always revisiting. So the question is, how do we actually come to a shared sense of direction so that we are, what we would aspire to do is consistent with the national strategy, because the HSE is not going to allow us to go off and do our own thing, completely ignore. If you look at what happened with cancer services and the cancer strategy, it rationalised cancer services in 8 designated cancer centres, the exception being for Letterkenny because of the geography of Donegal and the distances, but not for all cancers. So we still have some cancers that have to go elsewhere. So how do we find a path to be able to move forward in terms of developing what we need to develop in this hospital and ensure that what we do will be safe, it'll be sustainable, and it'll be appropriately staffed with the support of national. So it's a long introduction, because what I want to talk about next is sounds to many people as, well, it's just management speak, isn't it? But it is important. I was looking at the notices out in your waiting room, you know, what people said about the role of Highland. If we're not clear what we want to do as a hospital team and as a community, well, we're never going to get there because we're going to be at a loss.
So before you get to that, can I phrase this a different way and see if it aligns to what you say? Because you yourself come in for a lot of criticism. You know, you're a lightning rod for criticism because of your title primarily and others senior higher ups there. But is it a case that you and the others, as you've outlined, maybe you won't like the terminology, go into those meetings fighting for Letterkenny?
Of course we fight for Letterkenny.
Yeah, oh, no, but that's not how you phrased it.
Yeah, no.
Sean, that's not how you phrase it. My point is that, you know, rather that, and this is how I try and frame our coverage of Letterkenny University Hospital, right? We're not here to criticise it. I don't see that. And we always do the caveats, right? We're here to support you, the rest of the staff, whatever it is, even if it gets it out there. So we're not working against. I hope I'm seen as working with the hospital. So that's why maybe I just wanted to phrase it that in these meetings, when you're meeting people from all over the various regions and SAILTA, that you and your teams are fighting for Letterkenny University Hospital and its services and how those services can be provided safely and within the national guidelines.
Absolutely we are. But and again, just to be absolutely fair and measured on it, I'm not saying we always see eye to eye, but again, SAILTA is also fighting to develop the region, the SAILTA group, and Letterkenny Hospital. And sometimes it's about how do we actually make sure that we're actually standing shoulder to shoulder, not at variance with each other in that process.
Right, okay.
And to get a shared understanding. And sometimes also, you can fight, but can you fight smarter? Can you fight better? There's nothing better than getting people to understand where you're at to get their support. Right? You know, all the shouting in the world at people in Dublin, if they don't understand the realities that we have, then we're on a losing battle. So what can we do better in communicating that? So I'm conscious of time. One of the first things we did, it came out of the workshop, said, okay, we need to very, very clearly define and share with our staff what it is we think our purpose, our vision, and our values are as a hospital. Not just as a hospital, but as a hospital within SAILTA. Something that we buy into, that SAILTA buys into, that we're all committed to working together to achieve. So we developed a draft out of the workshops, and then we brought a group staff from over about 25 plus staff from different disciplines, different grades of staff, and said, what do you think about this? And they came back and said, that doesn't mean much to us. That's not particularly real. I don't like the way that's phrased. And, you know, that just sounds like management jargon. And they made changes, and they said, but we don't feel, you know, we're representative enough. But we redrafted the Steve White team that we're working with then took it all, redrafted all the based on all the comments and feedback, and then we did a staff survey and said, what do you think? And then the staff survey gave feedback, and again the statements were amended again. And last week we had a series, we started at 8 in the morning, we finished at 8 in the evening, a series of presentations to all our staff saying, and this is what came out of the process and this is how we're going forward. So so if you bear with me for a few minutes, so these are the following elements. And I'm not going to read all of them because the last one particularly is very lengthy. So we said that the purpose of this hospital is that in everything we do, we will deliver patient-centred care so that we ensure safe, high-quality, equitable and sustainable services to all. We then talked about the vision. So what is our vision for where we're going? That we will be a leading university hospital with skilled caring staff using passion and pride to provide timely, accessible, excellent patient-centred care to our patients and community. And the passion and pride bit, I'd just like to comment on, because I say this all the time, and you've heard me say it last time, I've worked in many hospitals in my career. I've never worked in a hospital that was so embedded in the community. Our staff, our members of this community, we all live here, we all have family here. So we have a pride in our hospital and in our community, and we have a passion to make it work.
Because, and I think that was demonstrated too with the awful tragedy in Greece. I think that demonstrated in a very, very
absolutely
way.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we identified that our values, our core values, are that we will be are always caring, always compassionate. And if you look at what the national HSE service and even the last HICVA inspection said, the patients' feedback was that they felt they were treated with care and compassion, and that's really important for us. That we're always learning. It's not enough just to keep doing the same old things. Medicine's changing, we're always learning, and always trustworthy. And then we identified a number of what we call mission statements. So how do we deliver this? And I'm not going to read all these out because they're a bit wordy, but I paraphrase them. And again, we're putting posters up around the hospital. Visitors, patients will see these and can read them at their leisure. But that we have a culture of respect and openness, that we have appropriately resourced skilled staff to deliver this. Because we are a business of people providing care for people. And if you don't have the people to provide the care, we don't do it well. That we'll have timely streamlined, equitable access to care. And we know we have huge challenges there. That we have clearly aligned patient governance. So how we run the hospital and this chain of decision making and the feedback is strengthened and becomes much more effective. We value and empower and support our staff in that process. And back to that point about our staff are key in everything we do. That we'll foster academic partnerships for education. We need to actually make sure our staff have the skills that they need. But we need to bring people, when they're in training, into Donegal to actually see that this is a place worth living, worth working in. That's a huge help to recruitment. That we will embrace innovative and integrated patient-focused care, including digital health. Really, the Irish healthcare system is still scraping at the margins of what technology can do, and we need to drive that. And we will have the highest standard, well-designed, modern, and well-equipped infrastructure. And that's one of our biggest challenges at the moment.
It is. Now, and there might be more, but...
Yeah, no, that's it.
Okay.
You'll be glad to know, right?
Sorry, it only took 25 minutes, joke. Sean... We all want that.
Yeah.
Okay. But now, but what happens is that's offset by maybe people's experiences recently. We get, and we read all of them, people's positive experiences. And there's some brilliant, brilliant experiences, but we also get the horror stories as well. So how do you, what we want, what you want, what the staff want, all of that sounds fantastic. How do we get there? And how much of it can be done from within the hospital? And how much of it requires CLT support?
Oh, okay. So there's just the last part. a significant amount requires sales to support. Some of it requires sales to change in as well, because so this isn't just a project about Letterkenny. It's about Letterkenny as part of the sales group. So how does the interactions, how do you change it? So essentially, what we came out of the workshops was not just a series of aspirations, but also then the program said, okay, so in order to make that happen, we need to do a lot of change, and we need to do it and in a structured way. And the structure was we would have five work streams. One was on leadership, accountability, and governance structures. And so I'll come back in a few minutes to that. One was on communication engagement with our staff, but with the community. One was on patient safety and quality improvement. One was on knowledge and skills. And one was on information, having the information to make decisions. So they were the five work streams. And out of those, within those work streams, then there's a number of projects that we are initiating. Starting now, and this is the start of a journey, Greg. This is not going to be tomorrow and it's all going to be fixed. Right? This will go on for a number of years, but starting now, we're working through a number of key priorities within each of those. So give you a couple of examples. Governance and structure, organizational structures doesn't mean a lot maybe to members of the public and even often very on our own staff. But does everyone who work in the hospital know, which, because we have lots of committees, we have lots of four of our people get together to discuss issues and look to solve problems. Does everybody know where decisions are being made, how they can feed into it, how they get communicated from it? And do we align those structures with SAILTA or with National to make sure when we identify that we need additional resources or we need additional advice or whatever, that we're plugged in and we're maximising that. We're not wasting time or missing opportunities. So that's part of the looking at our committee structures, looking at our governance structures. Where are we making decisions and where are we just communicating? Communication is self-evident, so conscious time, I won't go into that. Knowledge and skills I've already talked about. Mm-hmm. Where are the deficits? Where are the things we could do better? And where are the strengths? There are some really good things in the hospital. That. But success is built on building on your strengths. Mm-hmm. You don't ignore your strengths.
No, of course not.
Patient safety and quality. We know from some of the issues, we know from patient feedback, the frustrations of people feeling they weren't communicated, they weren't told what was happening, there was confusion. So again, one of the first big projects not is the clinical communications between both different specialties, but also between different staff groups. Are the nurses and doctors all up to speed with what decisions are happening with patients? Are we making sure the diagnostics are being ordered in time, and results are getting back quickly, and that the patient's being kept in the loop? So there's a huge amount of work to be done there. So to facilitate us within that, one of the things that SAILTA also funded was the appointment of a temporary project manager to actually support that process. And again, that was covered. I know as
I have more questions for you.
I'll stop talking and try and answer the questions.
I get you. That document, is that a recruitment document as well to some extent? Do you think prospective consultants or nurses or those considering moving to Letterkenny will want eyes on that? Is that part of this process?
We will be sharing it with any prospective. Yeah. Because think about it. Do you want somebody working in your organisation that doesn't understand what your values are and aren't bought into it?
So we will use it. But it recognises there are failings and that we have a plan to improve them.
It's a roadmap for where we want to go for
when next. I spoke to you last year could have been 2 years ago with COVID, I haven't a clue when it was. But there was, say, for instance, I raised one issue with you. It's about how triage worked, or about how people had to stand and effectively shout their condition at the kiosk, effectively. And he says, right, we might have a look at that. A, was anything done about that? B, I remember speaking to you and you said that you'd make chairs in the A&E or the ED more comfortable. You said that was going to happen next week, I think, or the second week. Did that ever happen?
Okay, so...
And I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
It's a fair question, right? So the answer is yes. We ordered 40 plus pads for the seats.
Where are they?
Good question. They were there for a period and over.
Because I went on social media. Yeah, I know.
I've been up there, right? The pads have all disappeared. Over the 4 months.
Stolen, effectively. Or taken.
D- disappeared, right? Nobody seems to know where they've gone to, right? Right, okay. But they have disappeared, stolen, taken, whatever. I can't. Now, about 4 weeks, so that design was selected before I came to Letterkenny when they designed the emergency department. On the view that it couldn't be damaged, it couldn't be ripped. They, you know, we've all seen tatty emergency departments.
I know what you mean, yeah.
Infection control. They couldn't be used as weapons, and they were both in the floor, and patients won't be on them very long. That's not the reality. They're not fit for a purpose. Again, about 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago, I noticed a number of complaints about the chairs. I actually asked, and I was told, oh, but the pads were definitely ordered, they were put into supply, and they're not up there. I've been up there, they're not up there. Yeah. And we don't know where they've all disappeared since they came in last October. So I said, right, that's it. No more pads, no more nothing. Change the chairs. So I can tell you now today, Greg, I don't have a timeline on it because I wasn't expecting that question, but the chairs are being changed, and the nurse manager up there is working with our facilities people to identify what would be fit for purpose.
Well, good luck selling on the ones that are in there, because I don't think anyone's going to take them off.
It's scrap metal somewhere. in terms of the other issue about privacy at the cable, that is something that we haven't resolved. We did put a microphone system in, and it hasn't seemed to have helped.
Right.
But again, this is...
scale of things, they're not significant, but it's just that there are a couple
of
things
significant.
That we...
make a bad experience worse, right?
Right. So, and then cases where we hear about people being asked personal questions in front of others, you covered in that. That is part of when you consult with people. That's recognised as an issue.
Yes.
You mentioned the appointment of a change implementation manager. Is that person above you, below you, alongside you?
Below me. Right. So,
it's fine.
Phrase, right? I wouldn't say he's a colleague, right? I don't like to talk in terms of people below me. Very conceited.
I understand,
this person isn't at a lower grade, but as a senior person with lots of training.
And their job is to address governance issues.
No, their job is to help us implement the work programs.
Okay.
Right. So this is important, because I think there's this confusion. So I said we have 5 work streams. So the work streams then are being headed by people. So for instance, if you take governance issues, right? So we have a sales chief director, a clinical director for governance and sales. So that clinical director for governance, myself, the chief operating officer, the sales quality manager, the Letterkenny quality manager, the director of nursing, we sit in a group with the project manager and identify what the priorities are, what we need to do, and the project manager helps make that happen by pulling together the people, by actually creating the... because that group won't solve it all. You then have... We divide... So we've said each group will have 3 priorities for the next 6 months, and it'll be a team pulled together to address that priority, get that done, and move on to the next one, so it doesn't drag out forever.
Sean, thank you. I just want to frame this for listeners as well, because Sean, in fairness, does come on the show and answer questions. Today was about outlining this new plan to see where it goes. Now, our job, your job over the next while, is to see how we progress in relation to that. But the purpose of this interview, rather than hit you with a ton of questions, was to give you an opportunity to outline, and on behalf of the staff as well, who are fingerprints are all over this document, outline what it's about, what it hopes to achieve, and now we suck it and see.
Absolutely, Greg. And just if I could leave in a positive note, because I'm sure lots of people listen and say, it's words, it's talk, what's happening. So we know one of the biggest challenges we have at the moment is space within the hospital. So at this point in time, we are actively working to rent off-site accommodation to develop an ambulatory urology service. We know it's been one of our, talked about building on our strengths. It's been one of our success stories, but we could do a lot more with the people we have if they had the space to operate on. So that's actually progressing. We know the pressures in the emergency department and for children and adults. So we put a proposal in for a modular extension to create extra capacity. 2 weeks ago, I got informed that we had gotten past the first stage of approvals, and we can now go for a full detailed submission, which takes a lot of work to put in, but it starts it on the process. And similarly with our orthodontic department, we've got through the first stage, and again, we're working. So there, you know, this is all backed by tangible, real activity going on in terms of recruitment, buildings, etc. But all of those will take time to actually come to fruition. We're also upgrading, by the way, we talk about patient experience, our surgical one ward at the moment. And if anyone has in, the old orthopaedic ward has gone seen since we got upgraded, that upgrade. And that came from upgrading from funding from SAILTA and national funding. So we are dependent on support from outside.
Right, we have to go for a break. Listen, Sean, thanks very much for calling up. Back in a sec. Okay, we're really right up against the clock here. By the way, got a commitment from Sean Murphy there, the manager of Letterkenny University Hospital. What we're going to do in two or three weeks, and I'll give you advanced warning, is give you an opportunity to ask specific questions. So we had some questions coming in there about diabetes care and some other matters, okay? So what we're going to do is, at some point, I will invite you to send in your questions. You can do it now if you wish. And we will bring Sean Murphy back on. He's agreed to answer those things specifically. Right, so in terms of, and I can think of a dozen off the top of my head, but I don't want them to come from me. I want them to come from you. So stay tuned for that. Again, I didn't want to bombard him with questions today because I want him, a lot of the staff got involved in creating that plan, and I wanted to give him an opportunity to outline the contents within it. But rest assured, in a couple of weeks, we're going to have a specific amount of time, and we might even put an hour over onto it, whereby your specific questions about the hospital will be answered. Okay, so that's coming up. That's where I have to leave it now. Thanks very much to producer Caroline and Niamh working on the show. John Bresson's coming up next. We're back with you tomorrow morning, all being well, from 9.